Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the February 2nd, Wednesday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. Today we'll be reading the following main articles. Broncos Officially for Sale by Ryan O'Halloran, the Denver Post. Regulators Consider Orphan Cleanup by Judith Kohler, the Denver Post. Federal Money is on the Way to Cap Wells by Conrad Swanson, the Denver Post. Team Expected to Garner Record-Setting Price by Ryan O'Halloran, the Denver Post. A decision that became inevitable more than 2 years ago amidst sibling strife in the Bolin family became reality Tuesday when the Broncos announced the team is up for sale. 38 years after Pat Bolin and his two brothers and one sister bought a majority interest in the team for $78 million, the Broncos are expected to easily break the current record sale price of $2.35 billion for a U.S. professional sports team set by the NBA's Brooklyn Nets. President CEO Joe Ellis, one of three trustees designated by Bolin to run the Broncos' day-to-day operations 7 years ago, informed the Pat Bolin Trust's seven beneficiaries of the official decision during a conference call. The Broncos are a special franchise that is part of the fabric of this region, and whoever emerges as the new owner will certainly understand what the team means to our great fans and the community, Ellis said in a statement. The record sale price for an NFL franchise is $2.275 billion for the Carolina Panthers. The Broncos' final price could reach $4 billion. Under Bolin, the Broncos won three of their Super Bowl appearances, 13 AFC West titles, and had 24 winning seasons. He retired from day-to-day Broncos business in July 2014 and died of Alzheimer's in June of 2019. When Pat Bolin purchased the Denver Broncos in 1984, he set out with a goal of being number one in everything, the Bolin family said in a statement. Over the past 38 seasons, his vision enabled the Broncos to become champions on and off the field. The trustees, Ellis, team counsel Rich Slivka, and local attorney Mary Kelly have hired Steve Greenberg of Allen & Company as their financial advisor and Joe Lachise of Proxauer Rose LLP as their legal advisor. Allen & Company has previously worked as an advisor for the New York Mets, Facebook, Time Warner, Cable, and AOL during acquisitions and mergers. Notable alumni of Proxauer Rose include the late NBA Commissioner David Stern and current NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman. The role of Allen & Company is vetting all prospective buyers and to insulate the trustees from having direct contact with the buyers. Selling an NFL team is a complex process involving numerous parties and league approval procedures, Ellis said. Nonetheless, the trustees hope to have the sale completed by the start of the 2022 NFL season. Once selected by the trustees, a prospective owner must meet with the NFL's finance committee. If they approve the candidacy, it moves on to the ownership group, and 24 teams must vote yes for approval. The timetable isn't set by the trustees or their advisors, a sports industry source said in a phone interview with the Denver Post. Instead, the calendar is based on how quickly the buyers emerge. It is expected that each potential buyer will sign a non-disclosure agreement once they officially express interest, which prohibits them from publicly revealing details of the process and who has or hasn't placed a bid. The trustees, whose fiduciary responsibilities are to the beneficiaries, two daughters from Boland's marriage to Sally Parker, and two sons and three daughters with his widow Annabelle are expected to accept the highest bid. The format is expected to be auction style. The trustees will be the ultimate decision makers on which prospective buyer will be selected, and they are expected to be in daily contact with their financial and legal advisors to answer and ask questions throughout the process. Two key NFL rules during the sale process. A majority owner must purchase at least 30% of the club, and they can't bring in more than 24 partial share investors. The sports industry source, based on previous NFL team sales, said the Broncos' new owner will likely own 100% of the club or close to it. The Panthers, David Tepper, Miami Dolphins, Stephen Ross, and Buffalo Bills, Terry and Kim Pegula, were all 100% purchases. The new owner will be the fifth in Broncos history, following Bob Housen, 1960, Gerald Phipps and Carl Coons, 1961 and 1980, Edgar Kaiser, 1981 to 1984, and Boland, 1984 to present. Last August, Forbes valued the Broncos at $3.75 billion, 10th in the NFL and 25th in the world among sports franchises. In 2018, two of Boland's daughters went public with their desire to replace their father as controlling owner. Beth Boland Wallace, the second of Pat's two children with Parker, had her request quickly denied by trustees. 4 months later, Brittany Boland, one of Pat's five children with Annabelle, said she wanted to succeed her father. Brittany eventually joined the Broncos in December 2019 as vice president at a vice president level, and she was promoted to her current post of senior vice president of strategy. Brittany Boland was the trustee's preferred choice to replace Pat, but on December 30, 2019, Ellis said unanimous family support for Brittany may not be a requirement, but it's going to be necessary moving forward. The Broncos, Ellis said, would ultimately be sold if it wasn't achieved. The path to putting the team up for sale was delayed by two lawsuits. In September 2019, Wallace and her older sister, Amy Klemmer, filed a petition seeking to invalidate the 2009 Patrick D. Boland Trust on the grounds their father did not have the capacity to sign his estate planning documents and the trustees had unduly influenced him. A July 2021 trial date was vacated and the lawsuit was dismissed at the request of Giovanni Ruschetti, the lawyer for Wallace and Klemmer, when both sides stated the estate planning documents were valid, enforceable, and reflect Patrick D. Boland's intent and will. And on January 11th, in Denver's 2nd District Court, a judge ruled Kaiser's right of first refusal provision was not transferable or enforceable. The Broncos succeeded in saying the right of first refusal disappeared upon Kaiser's death in 2012 and Boland's death 7 years later. In their statement, the Boland family said, "Our family is eternally grateful for the coaches, support staff, and team employees for all their contributions. Pat used to say the Broncos belonged to the fans, that ultimately, this was their team. From the bottom of our hearts, thank you for this incredible ride. It has been an honor of a lifetime." Who pays to restore sites? Regulators consider orphan cleanup. State Commission looks at proposals on getting companies to close or plug wells, by Judith Kohler, the Denver Post. Proposed rules intended to ensure that companies have the money to close and clean up oil and gas well sites in Colorado are too weak and won't protect taxpayers from having to pay the bill, proponents of the reform say. However, the industry and its supporters contend the increased demands will force companies to do what the state is trying to avoid, walk away from wells because they can't afford to restore the sites. The proposals before the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission would increase the bonds of other financial assurances that companies have to provide to serve as a guarantee that they will close or plug wells and restore disturbed land. After 6 days of hearings over the past few weeks, the five-member commission started working Monday on proposed reforms mandated by a 2019 law that overhauled the regulation of oil and gas. A decision isn't expected until later in February. Our statutory mandate is to ensure that we require every operator to provide assurance that it is financially capable of fulfilling every obligation imposed by the law, said Jeff Robbins, commission chairman. The fear is the public will get stuck paying if companies go bankrupt or walk away without cleaning up, leaving what's called orphan wells. Another concern is so-called zombie wells, ones that produce little or no gas and whose owners might not have the money to properly maintain or close them. The town of Erie has 130 active wells, 204 plugged wells, and miles of pipelines and gathering lines within its border, said Christian Van Woudenberg on the Erie Board of Trustees. Even if no new wells are ever drilled in Erie, we will forever be dealing with the legacy of this infrastructure. Van Woudenberg said companies would be held responsible to minimize the hazards while wells are active and should be responsible for plugging and restoring the sites when they have no longer when they're no longer producing. Kirby Wynn, the oil and gas liaison for Garfield County, assailed the thinly veiled fear-mongering about thousands of wells headed to orphan well status. Wynn, who was representing a group of rural counties, said he sees the need to improve the bonding requirements, but many local communities depend on the economic viability of oil and gas production and reasonable cost-effective regulations. At the core of the debate is whether companies should provide some kind of financial assurance, a surety bond, cash bond, letter of credit for each well, or allow them to continue paying blanket bonds that cover several wells. Operators have been able to post a $100,000 bond to cover all their wells statewide, an amount that critics say likely won't cover the cost of shutting down even one well. The proposed rules are a combination of approaches that are being criticized by all sides. Colorado has grappled for a few years with how to handle orphan wells, and now the Biden administration has taken up the cause. The Interior Department said Monday that Colorado is eligible to apply for a first phase of funding, which includes up to $25 million for an initial grant. The money comes from $1.15 billion in the infrastructure bill passed by Congress in late 2021. State officials estimate Colorado will be eligible for a total of $93 million under the program and have proposed using it for the state's orphan well fund. Colorado has about 49,850 active wells and is the country's fifth largest oil producer and seventh largest natural gas producer. There are 625 designated orphan well sites, although more than 200 of the wells have been closed, the Oil and Gas Commission said. Tackling orphan wells. Revenue from a mill levy on oil and gas companies has been used to clean up orphan sites. The industry and supporters have said throughout the hearings that no orphan well emergency exists. But in a 2017 letter to legislators, Matt Lepore, former director of the Oil and Gas Commission, warned that costs to take care of orphan wells could be at least six times greater than the financial assurances held by the state for the work. In 2018, former Governor John Hickenlooper directed a working group to recommend ways to strengthen the state's regulations. And in 2019, the Colorado General Assembly passed Senate Bill 181 to revamp oil and gas regulations to prioritize protecting public health, safety, and the environment. The proposed rules don't meet the law's mandate of requiring each operator to demonstrate that it's financially capable of meeting all its obligations, said Mike Freeman, an attorney for Earth Justice, who is representing the community and environmental groups in the hearings. Freeman said the industry wants to expand the number of companies that could still post blanket bonds rather than bonds for each well. The proposed rules limit the provision to companies with higher producing wells. Companies with lower producing wells would have to provide financial backing to cover the cleanup costs of each well, an approach favored by some cities and counties, community and environmental groups. But another option would allow companies to propose their own financial plans would create a situation where the loophole would just swallow the entire rule, Freeman said. The real bottom line is that the commission for years has let companies avoid posting adequate bonds to cover their operations, and what you see that here is industry pushing to keep that arrangement, Freeman said. Industry representatives denounced the single well financial assurance requirement as a one-size-fits-all approach. Mark Matthews, an attorney representing the Colorado Oil and Gas Association, said the proposals don't consider whether mid-sized or small companies could obtain millions of dollars in bonds in a tightening market. Trevor Gilstrap with the insurance broker Assured Partners said, "The bond market has become tougher for oil and gas companies because of a handful of massive losses in the industry. If the proposals are enacted, once stable companies might not be able to keep operating in Colorado. Instead of decreasing the number of orphan wells, we'll see a precipitous increase," Gilstrap said. Wes Wilson with Be the Change, a group advocating stronger regulations, said demanding full bonding up front won't cause a company to be insolvent, but might expose financial problems. If they can't pay their operating costs, of which proper well closure is one, then they aren't solvent, said Wilson. We should pass those costs to the public through regulatory inaction. Federal money is on the way to cap wells, by Conrad Swanson, the Denver Post. Colorado can expect tens of millions from the federal government to plug and restore hundreds of orphan oil and gas wells out of the bipartisan infrastructure bill that Congress passed last year, government officials said. In all, the infrastructure bill set aside $4.7 billion nationally to clean orphan wells, and White House officials broke down how the first $1.15 billion would be spent during a news conference Tuesday. So far, 26 states qualify for $25 million each, an additional allotment tailored for each state and calculated off the number of oil and gas jobs lost there, how many orphan wells likely remain, and their estimated restoration costs. White House spokesperson Rikia Dorsey-Craig said in a release, Colorado qualified for another $14 million, bringing its total allotment to $39 million. Never before has this country taken up a cleanup effort like this, White House Infrastructure Coordinator and Senior Advisor Mitch Landrieu said during a news conference. This is good for our health, good for our culture, and good for our workers. Wells are orphaned after the companies that dug them walk away, sometimes after going bankrupt, without restoring the site. They can leak toxic and explosive gases into neighborhoods and leak pollutants into the groundwater. Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission Director Julie Murphy said the state has 625 orphan wells, which could cost $47 million to plug, remediate, and reclaim. The commission is considering new regulations to ensure that companies in the industry have enough money to close and clean their wells. That work stems from an industry overhaul lawmakers passed in 2019 meant, in part, to ensure taxpayers wouldn't be left with cleanup costs if companies abandon their wells. Local governments and environmentalists say those reforms aren't going according to plan, though. They point to a proposal that would allow companies to continue offering a blanket bond of $100,000 to cover all their wells statewide. The commission has estimated that it costs an average of $82,500 to plug and reclaim a single well. The incoming federal money is good news for Colorado, Bo Kickless of Conservation Colorado said. But let's not be fooled. It's also a stinging rebuke of an industry that's amassed profits at the expense of our communities and by leaving taxpayers holding the bag, Kickless continued. The move also represents a call to action. Kickless, the organization's public lands advocate, said, and the commission should more strongly hold oil and gas companies accountable through robust annual well fees, full cost bonding for new transferred and low producing wells. Aside from orphan wells, Colorado has up to 19,000 wells producing less than the equivalent of 2 barrels of oil each day, according to Kate Ohl, a spokeswoman for U.S. Senator Michael Bennett. In a joint release with fellow U.S. Senator John Hickenlooper, Bennett said in a release, the incoming federal money will cut harmful methane pollution, create good-paying jobs and economic opportunities, and restore wildlife habitat in Colorado. Hickenlooper celebrated the funding and called the abandoned sites a danger to Colorado's communities and a hazard to the environment. Even more money will be on the way, Landrieu said. White House officials are letting states know how much they can expect through the life of the program. The senators said Colorado should see another $40 million. Barry Morphew, judge moves murder case to Canyon City for a fair trial, by Shelley Bradbury, the Denver Post. A judge on Monday moved the murder case against Barry Morphew into Fremont County on the grounds that Morphew could not receive a fair trial in Chaffee County, according to a court order obtained by the Denver Post. Morphew, 54, is charged with first-degree murder in the death of his wife, Suzanne Morphew, who was 48 when she disappeared from the family's Chaffee County home in May 2020. Investigators believe Barry Morphew killed his wife in a fit of rage after discovering she had carried on a months-long extramarital affair, then lied to police and hid evidence to try to cover his tracks. The murder trial, set for May 3rd, now will take place in Canyon City instead of Salida. This is a high-profile case in a relatively small county with a small jury pool, Chaffee County District Court Judge Ramsey Lama wrote in an order Monday night. The media saturation is high. The pretrial publicity in this case has been so massive, pervasive, and prejudicial that the defendant will not receive a fair trial in Chaffee County. Susan Morphew's disappearance captivated Salida and the community from the beginning. Both residents and the authorities conducted extensive searches for her several times throughout the year she was missing. Some potential jurors in the community seem to have already made up their minds about Morphew's guilt or innocence, Lama wrote in the order. One friend and neighbor of Barry Morphew told the judge that he initially supported Mr. Morphew, but came to believe he was guilty after reading the arrest affidavit. Lama wrote in the order, finding that his attitude was reflected in others across the county of about 16,500 residents. After a motions hearing in Chaffee County District Court in Salida on Tuesday, future court proceedings will be held at the Fremont County Courthouse in Canyon City, about 60 miles away. That's a relatively nearby pick for a change of venue, former Boulder District Attorney Stan Garnett said Tuesday. This is certainly an argument that moving it to another county within the same judicial district doesn't really remove it far enough from the media cycle, he said. On the other hand, this is a case that has pretty high profile. I've been reading about it in the Denver papers a couple of times a week. It may be simply that they felt they had to get it out of this one town to a different community that was some distance, and apparently the court still felt Fremont County was sufficient. Changes of venue are generally discouraged in Colorado's courts and are uncommon, said Sam Kamen, the Chauncey G. Wilson Memorial Research Chair at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law. He added that the judge's decision offers pros and cons. Solomon didn't actually split the baby in half, but it does kind of give something to both sides here, he said. We'll move it out of what the court thinks is the hotbed of all this pretrial publicity, but still make it close enough to people will be able to attend. Defendant can be transported. All of those logistical things can be taken care of. Congestion reduction strategy. I-25 pilot project expands to I-225, the 470 Beltway, judged by John Aguilar, the Denver Post. State transportation officials are about to put a congestion reduction strategy on Interstate 25 south of Denver into high gear, with plans this month to expand a precision-driven ramp signaling system to traffic choked connections at I-225, E-470, and C-470. Colorado Department of Transportation Smart 25 project manager Zach Miller said, adding that the big interchanges on I-25 in Douglas and Arapaho counties to the effort to manage the flow of traffic through the Denver Tech Center is critical to the system. When there is an accident on the highway, the system needs to be able to control these three large contributors to the main line, Miller said. And an incident on I-25, which sees upwards of 250,000 vehicles a day, can send motorists into paroxysms of frustration as taillights illuminate and forward progress gets stymied. It's why CDOT put in place the Smart 25 Managed Motorways pilot program last spring, hoping to use an array of roadbed sensors and computer algorithms to control motorists' access to I-25 with a fraction of a second precision never seen before in Colorado. CDOT borrowed the idea of coordinated ramp metering from Australia, where a decade ago Melbourne implemented it on a stretch of the M1 through the city. The results were dramatic. The number of vehicles getting through the highway increased by 25% during peak commuting periods, travel speeds improved 35% to 60% during peaks, and crashes went down 20% to 50%. Miller said CDOT won't know just how well real-time ramp metering is working on I-25 in Talt until all the data is in and analyzed, which he expects to be completed this summer. The algorithm has slowly increased until full activation was reached in late December, he said. Therefore, the current condition has been running only a few weeks. For most of last year, CDOT was in what it called a soft launch phase of the system, in which sensors on a 14-mile stretch of northbound I-25 between University Boulevard in Denver and Ridgegate Parkway in Lone Tree, plus a dozen sensing pucks at each of 15 ramps in the study area, feed traffic flow data to computers. Those computers, in turn, adjust the timing of a ramp's signal, red and green lights, in real time every 20 seconds or so, sometimes by as little as a tenth of a second, to keep things moving as smoothly as possible. But the real test of the system won't come until the meters on the ramps connecting I-25 to I-225 and the 470 Beltway around Denver are integrated into the network. The next step will be to monitor and make adjustments to the algorithm once the freeway-to-freeway ramp meters are turned on, Miller said. We expect changes on how the systems work when the freeway-to-freeway ramps are activated. If results prove hopeful this summer, CDOT could add southbound I-25 to the system and make it a permanent feature of the highway. Jeremy Hannock, director of the Public Works for Greenwood Village, said he hasn't noticed congestion relief on I-25 through the city yet. But he said cars trying to get on the highway are causing some crowding on the ramps. We are seeing the ramps back up more frequently as the pilot project continues to adjust the timings, he said. One issue, Hannock said, is that drivers aren't using the ramps as efficiently as they could, with a lack of utilization of the third lane that was created at a few of the interchanges. Miller, with CDOT, said the right shoulder on the ramps at Lincoln Avenue, as well as the East Dry Creek and Arapahoe roads, can be used when the ramp meter is active. But drivers don't always catch on, despite signs informing them of the situation. It has taken a while for motorists to get used to this new condition, Miller said. CDOT has been responsive to concerns from Centennial, where their primary concern is that traffic stopped on the ramps will spill into the city's streets, said Melanie Wood, strategic advisor for transportation and mobility in Centennial. CDOT shared, if the traffic backed up onto Centennial's arterials, the ramp meters would turn off, allowing cars to flow into the interstate, she said. Now I'll be reading from the Denver Post obituaries. Jill Louise Baer, June 28, 1942 to January 17, 2022. Jill Louise Baer of Denver passed away on January 17, 2022 at the age of 79. Jill was born on June 28, 1942 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. She attended Radnor High School and then earned her Bachelor of Arts degree at Penn State University. In August 1965, Jill married her husband of over 55 years, Ernest Herbert Baer. Together, they moved from PA to Salt Lake City, Utah, and then settled in Denver, Colorado for more than 51 years. Jill always raved about the clear blue Colorado skies and sunshine. She was a painter, singer, performer, fashionista, poet, avid reader, entrepreneur, businesswoman, volunteer, and event and community leader. Jill led a robust and accomplished career in advertising, marketing, sales, and public relations. She worked at several major companies, including IBM, Tracy Locke PR Agency, Boyer's Coffee, Pace Membership Warehouse, Stephen Covey and the Denver Newspaper Agency. Jill held an active leadership role in numerous community organizations, including the Women's Library Association, the Junior Symphony Guild, Volunteers of America, and Junior League, Central City Opera, and the Children's Diabetes Foundation. Jill spearheaded numerous fundraising efforts as president of the Denver Center Alliance for the Denver City of the Performing Arts. Jill made many television and newspaper appearances for her professional and community endeavors. She savored summer vacations at the seashore and boardwalk in Ocean City, New Jersey, beginning as a young girl and throughout her adult life. She loved sailing, the ocean breeze, the warm sand, the salty air, and sunshine. Jill loved to laugh, decorate, dress up, and share her cheer and creativity. Above all else, Jill loved and cherished her family. Jill Bear is survived by her devoted husband, Ernest, as well as their three treasured children, Kareen, Brant, and Kristen. Dedicated sons-in-laws, Sanford Summer and Benjamin Otten, loving daughter-in-law, Jamie Bear, and her eight cherished grandchildren, Cecilia, William, and Charles Summer, Emily Maxwell and Eric Bear and River Otten, her dear sister and brother-in-law, Dorothy and Anthony DiMarino Jr., and their larger family. She was preceded in death by her parents, Herbert and Dorothy, and her younger brother, Charles Jr. A public memorial service followed by reception will be held at 1 p.m. on February 5th, 2022 at Horan & McConaty, 5303 East County Line Road, Centennial, Colorado, 80122. Live stream for the service at bxcited.com/Jill/Bear, B-E-H-R. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to either Cure PSP at www.psp.org/iwanttohelp/ways-to-give, or to the Denver City for the Performing Arts in memory of Jill Bear. Cure PSP donations will support education, research, and hopeful care for the extremely rare neurodegenerative disease that Jill gracefully endured in her final years. Alternatively, DCPA donations will perpetuate Jill's abounding energy to inspire the Denver community through the power and education of live theater. Edwin Duane Dijon, beloved uncle, father, grandfather, husband, died surrounded by his family. Ed leaves his wife of 62 years, Karen Ruth Lochner Dijon, daughters Lynette Dijon, husband Jim Lamos, and Kendra Dijon, sons Mark Dijon, Brad Dijon, wife Samantha Blay Dijon, and grandchildren Morgan Hedlund, Austin Dijon, Ben Lamos, Cassie Dijon, Remy Dijon, and many nieces and nephews. Born in Dunlap, Iowa, Ed was the youngest of seven children of William and Ella Dijon. He moved with his family to Denver in 1948 and in 1955 graduated from Denver West High School, where he fell in love with Karen, his lifelong sweetheart. Ed most loved being with his family, coaching his children and grandchildren in sports, and playing golf with his friends. Celebration of Life, Saturday, February 5th, 11 a.m., Horan & McConaty, 3101 South Wadsworth Boulevard. In lieu of flowers, please make memorial donations in his name to the National Kidney Foundation. Betty C. Edler, October 5th, 1932 to January 21st, 2022. Betty C. Edler, 89, passed away on January 21st, 2022. Please go to HoranCares.com for full obituary. Marcus Andrew Hyde, 32, passed away January 20th, 2022. Please visit MonarchSociety.com for full obituary. Robert Bob Everett Losey passed away on Sunday, the 23rd of January, 2022. He was 94 years in the life. Bob was married to Nettie T. Losey of 70 years. She passed away the 17th of May, 2021. They are survived by their only child and son, Mark James Losey, a.k.a. Israel Argaman Tekelet, and various nieces and nephews. Bob was born in Trinidad, Colorado, on the Bowman Dairy, founded by his aunt and uncle Harry and Mary May Bowman. His mother, Julia Losey, passed away when he was 3 years old, and he started working on the dairy at the age of 9, going on the routes with his father, Henry Branch Losey, in the milk truck, running machinery in the dairy and also going to school. He graduated from Trinidad High School and also attended the University of Colorado. He served in the U.S. Army from 1946 to 1948 with the U.S. military government in Japan, and later with the U.S. Army Reserves and Intelligence from 1948 to 1957. He was honorably discharged as a technical sergeant. He also worked as a broker in the real estate company he founded, Mark J. Realty. He retired from the Jefferson County School District R1 as a construction estimator. He lived the American dream. He also looked for the good in people. Like his wife, Nettie, he was kind, generous, and modest person his whole life. Nettie and him were each other's first love, outstanding parents, and are missed very much. Harvey Newman. Harvey Newman, 85, Denver, husband of Benita Weingart Newman, brother-in-law of Mel and Sandra Weingart, and Roz and Austin Denson. Private burial service Thursday, February 3rd at 11:30 a.m. at Lighthouse Villas Clubhouse, 1011 South Valencia Street, Denver, 80247, door code 1936. Live stream on Feldman Mortuary's YouTube channel. J. Odie, November 29, 1969 to January 4, 2022, Denver District 1 police officer. Kevin J. Odie, age 52, survived by his son Dylan Odie, daughter Etika Sanchez, and his brother Scott Odie. Maxine Scubal, September 2nd, 1936 to January 23rd, 2022. Maxine E. Scubal Niebauer, born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin in 1936, passed away peacefully in her sleep in the early morning on Sunday, January 23rd, 2022. She is preceded by her death, Thomas G. Scubal. She is survived by her three sons, Michael, wife Holly of Pewaukee, Wisconsin, James, wife Chris of Hartford, Wisconsin, and Thomas, Johnette, wife Johnette of Littleton, Colorado, along with her seven grandchildren and eight great grandchildren. She was a beloved friend, mother, and wife to her husband, who passed in 2022. For more information, visit cfcscolorado.org/obituaries. Phyllis Swanson, July 1930 to January 29, 2022. Age 91 of Westminster, Colorado, passed away on January 29, 2022. Phyllis E. Swanson was born in July of 1930 in Wagon Mound, New Mexico. She spent her childhood in the Sopras Valley in southern Colorado. She was the oldest of eight siblings. She is predeceased by her parents, Jose and Sylvia, two sisters and three brothers, Emily, Geneva, Eddie, Ronald, and Raymond. She is survived by a brother, Joe of Colorado Springs, Colorado, and a sister, Marie of Malabar, Florida. She married Ernest Senna in 1951 and shortly after moved to the Denver area. She and Ernest had three children, Yvonne, Vivian, and Arnold. In 1984, she was divorced from Ernest and later married Will Swanson in 1990. Both Ernest and Will predeceased her. She is survived by daughter Yvonne and son-in-law Gary, daughter Vivian and son-in-law Russ, and son Arnold. She has three grandchildren, Jason, Desi, and Ayrton, and two great-grandchildren, Ellie and Avery. Phyllis was a longtime resident of Westminster in Arvada, Colorado. She had an adventurous spirit and enjoyed dancing, fishing, traveling, and cooking. She had many friends from the Polka Lovers Club of Colorado, her Sunrise Community, the Spirit of Christ Church, and Joan of Arc Church, both located in Arvada. Phyllis never met a stranger. The family gives thanks to all the caregivers who have cared for Phyllis in the last years of her life. No formal service is currently planned. A private family celebration of life will be held at a later date. Now I'll be reading some miscellaneous articles from the Denver Post. Denver's first alcohol-free mocktail bar starts to franchise, by Josie Sexton, the Denver Post. Less than a year since Billy and Christy Wynn started pouring mocktails at a wake in Jefferson Park, the couple is hoping to expand their non-alcoholic bar concept across Colorado and the U.S. Awake opened applications for franchises on its website this week. Interested business owners can start the process by filling out an inquiry form. We've been inspired by dozens of people from across the country who have reached out wanting to bring locally radically inclusive alcohol-free bar to the community, Billy Wynn said in a release. We're honored to offer this opportunity and support the normalization of not drinking. No franchises have been confirmed. We've been hustling to put this together in response to the numerous inquiries we've gotten from people in and out of the state, Billy Wynn said. Awake opened last May with around 40 alcohol-free beverage offerings. The bar serves coffee by morning and switches to non-alcoholic drinks around 4 p.m., noon on weekends. Menus of seasonal mocktails and elixirs, $7 to $14, are accompanied by sandwiches and snacking plates, $4 to $25. A bottle shop on site sells non-alcoholic beer, wine, and spirits to take home. 2240 North Clay Street, 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. Wednesdays through Saturday, until 5 p.m. Sunday, and until 3 p.m. Monday and Tuesday. New poll, a warning sign for Dems, but not POLUS, by Alex Burness, the Denver Post. Democrats have dominated Colorado state politics for years, but are by no means guaranteed to maintain control of the state house after the November election. The Democratic governor, Jared Polis, however, remains more popular in Colorado than his state capitol colleagues and President Joe Biden. That's according to a new poll by Signal, a national polling firm that works with GOP candidates and committees. The firm has a strong polling record and rates as trustworthy by the data journalism outlet 538. The poll was commissioned by the Republican State Leadership Commission, which works to elect Republicans at the state level. It was conducted January 17th and 18th, with a pollster speaking at 510 likely Colorado voters from all seven of the state's congressional districts. The voter registration breakdown in the pool of respondents roughly mirrored the overall statewide breakdown as reported by the Secretary of State's office. 29% Democrats, 26% Republicans, and 40% unaffiliated. Though it's slightly underweighted independent voters, 37%, and slightly overweighted those affiliated with two major parties, 60% total. Signal said its margin of error on the polls is 4.33%. Respondents were split when asked whether they feel things in Colorado are generally headed in the right directions or off on the wrong track, with 47.5% choosing the former and 45.9% choosing the latter. They were similarly split when asked whether they'd elect a generic Republican or Democrat to the state legislature, with respondents very narrowly leaning right, 43.7% to 42.6%. Colorado Democrats have controlled state politics since 2018, when they flipped the state Senate and maintained the state House and governor's office. They also control the offices of the Treasurer, Attorney General, and Secretary of State. The the University of Colorado Board of Regents, both U.S. Senate seats, and four of the Colorado 7 seats in the U.S. House. While their lead in the State House, 41 seats to 24, is safe from all but an unprecedented red wave election, the state Senate majority at 20 seats to 15 is more fragile. Republicans need only to flip 3 seats to win back the chamber. The governor's chances look strong, Signal found. The poll found negative net favorability ratings for Democratic Colorado state legislators, negative 13.1%, Biden negative 14.5%, and elected Democrats in D.C. negative 19%. But Polis rated with a net favorability of 6.6%. The Boulder Democrat has consistently polled well during his first term and is widely favored to win again this year. He's played his messaging safe during this re-election campaign, focused almost single-mindedly on kitchen table issues and avoiding more controversial topics such as abortion rights, gun safety, and election security. The Signal poll helps explain his positioning. A 30.7% plurality of respondents said addressing the cost of living should be the top priority for state government. That followed by getting things back to normal following the COVID-19 pandemic at 17.9% and creating jobs and growing the economy at 13.3%. Only 6.7% of respondents said social issues like the Second Amendment and abortion should be the top state house priority. The poll made no mention of climate change. Despite the governor's evident popularity, 47.4% of poll respondents said they would probably or definitely support Republican state legislature candidates who would act as a check and balance on Governor Polis, while 43.5% of respondents said they would probably or definitely support Democrat state legislative candidates who support the governor's agenda. Polis and state house Democrats, particularly progressives, have often been at odds during the governor's first term, including on labor issues, fiscal immigration, and climate change. They generally agree on social issues, but his libertarian views have made it more difficult for Republicans to paint him as a typical Democrat. Recently, Polis made a national name for himself as a rare Democratic governor who largely resisted strict public health measures such as mask mandates and vaccine requirements. Hundreds of Douglas County teachers plan to call out, by Jessica Seaman, the Denver Post. Hundreds of Douglas County school district employees, including teachers, are requesting substitutes for Thursday as they plan to call out of work in protest of recent actions taken by the newly elected school board, said the president of the teachers union on Tuesday. The protest comes a day after three members of Douglas County School District Board of Education allege that other board members are trying to force out Superintendent Corey Wise. The allegations, along with the board's recent decision to change the district's equity policy, is leading employees to take collective action and hold a rally on Thursday, said Kevin DePasquale, president of the Douglas County Federation. It was necessary to make a statement that draws attention to what's going on, he said. The board has undergone a shakeup after November's election when four new conservative members were elected. They now hold the majority on the board and have moved quickly to implement changes, including to the equity policy and lifting a mask mandate for schools. DePasquale did not know exactly how many of the district's more than 8,000 employees, including 3,400 classroom teachers, will participate in the call-out, but said he has heard more than 900 people have requested substitutes for Thursday. A spokeswoman for Douglas County School District confirmed a large number of staff are submitting absences for Thursday, but declined to provide an exact count, saying the number is changing constantly. We will continue to monitor those absence submissions, and should we reach a point where the number of absences will impact our ability to provide a safe and supervised learning environment for students, we will advise families should school closures become necessary, said Paula Hans in an email. The district has already canceled classes for Wednesday as a snowstorm is hitting the metro area. DePasquale said the snow could also hamper the union's plans for a rally at 1 p.m. on Thursday at the district's administration building in Castle Rock. On Monday, three members of the district school board, Elizabeth Hansen, Susan Meek, and David Ray, held a public meeting in which they alleged that the president and vice president of the board told Wise to resign by Wednesday or otherwise be voted out, a move they said was made without informing the rest of the board. They also said they believed these actions violated Colorado open meeting laws, which govern how decisions are discussed and decided by public officials. That threw a big wrench in people wanting to even stay here because we finally have a superintendent who listens to staff, DePasquale said. Any formal decision about Weiss's employment status will take place during a public meeting, said Mike Peterson, board president, in a statement. There has been no action taken on the superintendent's contract or employment status, he said. Last week's conversation was to provide our superintendent with information needed to participate in an ongoing discussion. I will continue to engage all board directions on this matter. Tesla recalls cars with full service driving by Neil E. Boudet, the New York Times company. Tesla is recalling 54,000 vehicles, cars equipped with its full service driving software to disable a feature that in certain conditions lets the vehicles roll slowly through intersections without stopping. The move comes after the automaker was criticized on social media for enabling rolling stops in violation of traffic regulations. Failing to stop at a stop sign can increase the risk of a crash, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration said in a letter to Tesla confirming the recall made public Tuesday. The action covers only Teslas that have been equipped with software that the company calls full self-driving and includes S, X, 3, and Y models that were produced at various times between 2016 and 2022. Full self-driving is more advanced than Tesla's more widely used autopilot driver assistance system. Despite their names, neither system can operate a car without active engagement by a human driver. Although Tesla allows customers to buy full self-driving software, it costs $12,000. The software is still in a test phase, and the company has allowed only a select group of customers to activate it. The rolling stop problem is the latest in a series of safety issues involving Tesla. In August, the Traffic Safety Agency opened a formal investigation into a series of crashes in which Teslas in autopilot mode struck emergency vehicles that had stopped or parked, often at the scene of an earlier accident. The agency is trying to find out why autopilots sometimes fail to see and stop for police cars or fire trucks with emergency lights flashing. A month later, Tesla issued an over-the-air update to improve the ability to recognize emergency vehicles. The safety agency responded by reminding Tesla the federal law requires a company to initiate a recall anytime it corrects a safety defect. The agency also ordered Tesla to provide data about its full self-driving software and raised concerns that Tesla might be preventing customers from sharing safety information with the agency. In November, Tesla modified the software on about 12,000 cars to fix a braking problem and filed a formal recall to document the move. The automaker also recalled 458,000 cars in December for two separate mechanical defects that could affect safety. Also in December, the safety agency opened an investigation into a feature that allowed front passengers or drivers to play video games on the dashboard screen while Tesla cars were moving. A day later, Tesla agreed to disable the feature. The rolling stop issue came to light after a Tesla software update in October added driving modes that could allow cars equipped with a system to roll through intersections at speeds of 5 miles per hour or less. The safety agency discussed the matter with Tesla twice in early January, and the company agreed to issue a recall and disable rolling stops January 20th, according to documents posted on the agency's website. Tesla told the regulator that rolling stops were allowed only at intersections when no cars, pedestrians, or bicyclists were detected. The company told the safety agency that it was not aware of any crashes that resulted from rolling stops by cars equipped with the full self-driving software, the document showed. The company did not respond to a request for comment. Thank you for joining us for the Wednesday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head.